as she skipped up the stairs. Meanwhile, Ruth continued to struggle at Brown's. "Tell us about Imogen, Ruth," Lillian begged. "What did she have for lunch yesterday?"
"I don't see why the great Imogen can never spare a moment to tell us herself," Myrtle complained. "The way Ruth tells it, it'll never be half as interesting." She was right. Ruth couldn't tell it. She tried to repeat what Imogen had said about the house and Mrs. Owens for them. She described the carpets and the view of the lake, the committees, the pillars, the little sandwiches, and even the garnish, but it all came out sounding dull and flat. Everything felt dull and flat to Ruth. The air had freshened slightly that morning, signaling the end of summer, but to Ruth, the coolness was more sad than invigorating. The morning at Brown's, always frustrating, was, without Imogen, also depressing and tedious. She noticed the stains and scuffs on the pale yellow walls and the dead flies heaped on the windowsills. "Well, the best part," Myrtle said, "is that sometimes she's all alone in that big house with that handsome boy. I know what I'd do."
"Imogen," Ruth said, "is nothing like you, Myrtle." Imogen was, however, paying even more attention to her appearance than usual. Trying all the scents Backy's stocked and being careful never to wear the same dress twice in one week. Fond as she was of the notion of herself and Ruth running their own advertising agency, now that she was working for Teresa Owens, she was no longer so naive as to think they could pull it off. The step she'd always glossed over in her imagination, arranging the meetings with important men and smart women, was both crucial and impossible. These sorts of people would never listen to her and Ruth. She'd met some of them in Mrs. Owens' living room. They thanked her when she handed them her neatly typed minutes. They even asked her opinion once in a while, because they liked her. Of course they liked her, everyone did. But she would never be one of them. Maybe if she were coldly ambitious. Maybe if she were wickedly clever. Maybe if she were a college graduate, she might be able to impress them. But she was none of these things. Imogen was a fair judge of herself. She knew she was reasonably bright, unwaveringly loyal and confident. She knew she had perseverance, good looks, and even charm. And she knew that these qualities alone did not add up to a brilliant career. They would, however, make for an excellent wife, given the right husband. When they'd first met at the dance, Imogen had seen Arthur more as an adjunct to Bobby Hanser than as a man unto himself. She'd hoped, in fact, that Ruth would like him when she'd suggested they dance. Maybe then the four of them might eventually double, since she realized her acceptance into Bobby's crowd wouldn't give her much happiness if Ruth wasn't admitted too. But his solicitousness with Ruth that night impressed her. Once she became Teresa's secretary, he joked with her around the house and often interrupted her work to ask for her help with projects of his own. He'd constructed an enormous scale model of the Brooklyn Bridge in the sunroom, which to her indicated remarkable talent, but pieces always needed reattaching, and she'd have to hold two bits together while he applied the glue. She decided he had a particularly winning smile, more quirky and open than Bobby's. Behind his glasses, his eyes, she determined, were exceptionally soulful. Obviously, he had a promising future and an excellent family. Soon enough, the pleasure of going to work was in the anticipation and thrill of his appearance in the office doorway, and soon after that, she stopped driving the Ford when she knew he'd be there, and looked forward all day to the evening when he would give her a ride home in his Pontiac coupe. Her plan to become Mrs. Arthur Owens was going very well, but it was difficult to include Ruth, although Imogen tried. "Last night he took me sailing to watch the sunset. It's like you're a gull, Ruth, so quiet and glidy. Next time I'll tell him we have to take you." "That's all right," Ruth said. She turned on the radio behind the bait shop counter and fiddled with the tuner. "But I want you to come. I want you to like him."
"I like him.
We're interested in the same things, travel and music. And he loved The Awful Truth. Remember how much I liked that movie? He's teaching me some of the newest swing steps, too. Here, I'll show you, so we can all do them next Friday." Ruth followed Imogen's steps, but she said, "You've never traveled anywhere. You've never even been to Chicago." "I want to, though. That's the important thing." Ruth stopped dancing. "We'll go to Chicago," she said pointedly, "when we start our advertising agency." She had to say it. She had to make Imogen admit she was spoiling everything, not just stand aside and let her go, as if there had never been any promises.
Imogene sighed. I know, I said I'd do that with you. You wanted to do it. You made me go to Brown's, and now you're not even there anymore.
I know, I did.
Imogene went behind the counter and hoisted herself onto the stool. She put her head in her hands for a moment, and then looked up again at Ruth.
The thing is, now I know that was just a game, just a childish fantasy.
How about sailing to watch the sunset, Ruth thought. That even sounded like a silly nursery rhyme.
Ruth, no one's going to buy ideas from us. We'd work and work if we could even get jobs.
I'm sure we could get jobs.
All right, Imogene raised her hands.
Yes, I guess we could get jobs. Mrs. Owen said she could get something for me in Chicago if I wanted it. Not in advertising, but a job. Ruth said nothing.
Imogene ran her fingers over the keys of the cash register.
But, she said, I guess I don't want to go anymore.
You have to understand. I can't help how I feel about him.
I would understand, she added, if it were you.
You wouldn't have to understand, Ruth thought, because I'd always put you first. And anyway, it wouldn't be me.
But she said, I know, I do understand.
But Ruth, Imogene said, leaning over the counter to take Ruth's hands, I want us to do things together, all three. You like him, don't you?
I know he likes you.
Why can't we all three be friends?
Ruth knew it didn't work that way, and she'd no desire even to see Arthur again after her embarrassing night on the boat. But after all, there was Imogene, looking so hopeful and eager.
We can, she said.
Of course we can, if that's what you want. Imogene and Arthur began to pick Ruth up at Brown's at the end of the day, and they'd all go over to Frederick's Pharmacy for malts. Arthur lent Ruth books, and they'd talk about them.
Did you like the minister's charge?
I don't know. I liked it up until the end. Then it was just too awful.
You didn't think he should have married Statira?
No, I think he made a terrible mistake.
To be trapped with one woman when he really loves another?
It's wrong.
But isn't he right to take responsibility for leading her on? He certainly behaved as if he meant to marry her, even after he knew he loved Jesse better.
Ruth sighed.
I guess I admire him for it, but it still seems a high price to pay for an innocent mistake. I mean, he thought he loved her, at first.
A high price? But she isn't so bad, is she?
No, of course not, but that's the other problem, what he's doing to her.
After all, what makes him think he's so special? He's robbing her of any chance to find someone who really loves her. Does he think no one else will?
He loved her once.
You remind me of Jesse.
Oh, no, she shook her head and bent over her straw, blushing.
I'm nothing like Jesse.
Who's Jesse? Imogene asked, sliding onto her stool.
She'd run out to examine a hat in Jackson's next door while they waited for their malts.
She's a bohemian, Arthur told her. An artist. She gives up the hero when she finds out another woman loved him first.
Does he love her?
Certainly, she's exactly what he's been looking for his whole life.
Then she's a fool, Imogene said.
All's fair in love and war.
You don't think some things are more important than love? Ruth asked.
No, nothing, Imogene said. She frowned at her malt.
I probably shouldn't drink this.
I hope you're not listening to my mother's crazy ideas, Arthur said.
I was, but if you think I look all right.
All right, sure, he said, smiling. You look all right.
Arthur's car was a two-seater, but they fitted three in easily, with Imogene leaning against Arthur's shoulder and Ruth wedged against the door. Amanda, waiting at the kitchen window for Ruth to come home, watched the girl nearly spill onto the drive when the car stopped. Imogene hung out the window, waving after her.
8 o'clock tomorrow night, she called.
Amanda had watched the Owens family closely enough to know the car and to guess who would be driving it.
Are they serious? She asked later, when she poured coffee first in Ruth's cup and then in her own and taken her seat at the table.
It was just the two of them now at supper, as long as Carl was away. Last spring, Rudy had decided he was too old to work on the farm, but apparently not too old to marry. They'd had the ceremony in the front room. Amanda had baked the wedding cake, and Ruth had played three songs on the piano, and Rudy had moved into his wife's house in town.
Are who serious?
Imogene and that Owens boy.
I don't know, Ruth shrugged.
She often felt she had to protect Imogene from Amanda's prying questions. Why was it any of her business? Amanda frowned. I would hope she'd have better judgment. There's nothing wrong with Arthur. He's the nicest boy I've ever met. Ruth was somewhat surprised to realize she believed this. Did he really think she was like Jesse? Careful, Amanda told herself. It's not worth making a fuss if it turns out to be a schoolgirl fancy. Hadn't Imogene been in love with some other boy just a few weeks ago? Well, I just meant they're only summer people, she said. I hope she knows there's no sense getting serious over summer people. Still, she thought, this would bear watching. She felt as if someone were playing a game with her, making a move and then sitting back with a cruel smile, waiting to see what she would do in response. So far, she hadn't made the right moves. That was obvious. Whatever her intentions in the clinch, she'd always let her instincts drive her. And her heart, as it turned out, was an idiot not to be counted on. Here she'd been, acting wrong again, even tonight, waiting behind the curtain for Ruth to come home, when it was Imogene she needed to worry about. In fact, raising Ruth was the only thing she'd done right. Amanda gazed across the kitchen where Ruth was now pumping water to wash the supper dishes. Probably she'd break one. She often did, hastily rattling the plates together, paying scant attention to the work. Amanda always felt exhilarated near Ruth's wild energy, even though she cringed at the clumsiness that accompanied it. While Ruth knocked things over right and left, Amanda hadn't lost her grip on a single fragile item since she dropped her mother's crystal vase that day Maddie and Carl were married. Keeping things whole, she reflected, rubbing the base of her thumb, demanded a great deal of concentration. After Arthur took Imogene home, he drove aimlessly along the country roads. That summer, the path he'd been following, the route chosen and painstakingly marked by his parents, had forked. His brother could arrange a place for him at the bank, or he could start some business of his own. His parents had made clear that their fondest desire was to finance an enterprise conceived and captained by Arthur E. Owens. But a sense that there might also exist some entirely different destination, one that he couldn't yet see, but which lay just beyond the obscuring undergrowth of long habit and expectations, troubled him and kept him from moving forward. He had no idea how to hack through that foliage, nor whether whatever he uncovered would please him, but neither did he want to follow blindly the manicured course on which his feet were already set. He was restless. He felt forces massing within him, ready to propel him in whatever direction he chose, but he could not decide. He had given himself the summer to loiter, but now it was fall. And then there was this girl, Imogene. He felt almost as if he'd conjured her up, the way he'd met her that night and then found her, sparkling and chattering, with her quick smile and easy laugh, at his mother's desk the next week. She clearly admired him, and his mother had indicated she would approve. "Sometimes a blank slate is best," she'd said. "There's something to be said for a girl who's open to influence." Teresa Owens believed it was important to be broad-minded when it came to love. Imogene was bright and pretty and obviously ambitious. She listened to concerts on the radio to teach herself to identify composers, and she asked his mother 100 questions about the paintings on their walls. When his mother bought her a ticket to see A Doll's House with them in Milwaukee, Imogene found a copy at the library and read it twice, and also Hedda Gabler and The Wild Duck for good measure. Out of the corner of his eye as he sat next to her in the theater, he saw her mouthing the lines. He knew it was patronizing of him, but he found her attempts to become cultured endearing. And beyond her looks and her charm, he admired her sense of certainty. She knew where she wanted to go and how to get there. It was tempting to align himself with someone like that, a woman who would take him in hand. Imogene's friend, however, confused him. Ever since that first night when Ruth had told him about her mother drowning, he'd wanted to say to her, "I found her. She's the lady in the ice." That her mother had called to him through that glassy blackness, that he'd been the one to find her, to discover her blue skin and staring eyes, made him feel close to Ruth, who seemed to hold herself apart. In the drugstore, he'd wanted to reach for a string of the hair that was always dripping down along her face, to twine it around his finger. At best, she looked ordinary. Her complexion was not especially clear, her eyes were too wide and her lips too narrow. Still, something reserved, even secretive, in her manner intrigued him. He was sure that she would take him somewhere he'd never been, somewhere he couldn't even imagine. "You drive," Imogene said to Ruth the following evening. "I'm too jumpy. You need the practice anyway." Imogene had given Ruth driving lessons the summer before, but they hadn't taken. She needed several tries to get the car moving, and she forgot to look left before she lurched into the road. "Don't you think he should have picked me up tonight, Ruth?" "But didn't he say he'd be driving out from town, that he'd be late? He wanted to be sure you were going, didn't he?" "He was just being polite, or curious, or... I don't know, but he should take me somewhere on a real date, if he means for this to go on after he moves back to town." Ruth concentrated on keeping the wheels on the road. "Did I tell you he gave me a four-leaf clover yesterday?" "No," Ruth said dutifully. She wished this would be over one way or another. Imogene and Arthur definitely together or definitely not. She wished she never had to hear another word about him. "I hope you pressed it immediately in a book of poetry," she said. Imogene buried her face in her hands and laughed. "Yes," she admitted. "I don't know what I'm going to do if he doesn't say something soon. I think I'm in love with him. Honest to God." She sat up straight in the seat then and changed her tone. "What I'm thinking is, I should dance first with Bobby. Then maybe with Ray. Make him wait his turn. Let him wonder a little bit. The trouble is, he can see me every day of the week if he wants to. He does see me almost every day of the week, so he doesn't realize that if he wants to keep, you know, seeing me, one of these days he's going to have to say something." Ruth was easing the car into the parking lot at the dance pavilion now. When she turned off the engine, music flooded through the open windows. It was the last dance of the summer. Already the vibrant green had begun to drain from the masses of leaves, and soon the world would draw itself into its hard shell. Even in a month's time, it would be nearly impossible to remember the smothery, soft lushness of summer nights. In a month's time, Arthur Owens might be gone. Imogene slammed the car door. "Now, Ruth," she said, leaning on her friend to keep from tipping in her new high-heeled sandals as they walked across the gravel, "if you see we're trying to be alone, you help me out, won't you? Distract Ray. You know how he loves to talk to you. He thinks you're a serious person. Or make him dance with that horrible Zita." The band had switched from a fast number to something dreamy, and the brilliant pavilion seemed almost to float on the dark water if you looked at it from the right angle. Even Ruth sensed its promise as she filled her lungs with the poignant air of the coming fall. "He's still not here, is he?" Imogene whispered to Ruth as Ray escorted her back to their table. But just then, he was coming toward them.
"Behind you,"
Ruth whispered, and Imogene turned and intercepted him. As she led him by the hand smoothly onto the dance floor, he looked over his shoulder once toward Ruth, but she was turned away from him, talking to Ray.
"Not so hot tonight, is it?" Ray said.
"Yes, it's nice." "Arthur looked at me," Ruth thought, and felt ashamed.
"I suppose we could dance, if you want to," Ray offered.
"Maybe in a little while." It was ridiculous, despicable, wanting Arthur to look at her. Ruth felt a little sick to her stomach, thinking of it.
"Well, I'm about ready to get myself a drink. Want anything?"
"Yes, please, Ray, whatever you're having." While she waited for him to return with the drinks, Ruth tried to comfort herself with the knowledge that she was merely being foolish. After all, a glance, a kindness, a dance, an idle compliment, they meant nothing, of course, nothing outside her own silly mind. But wasn't that the horror of it? That there was no true feeling between Arthur and herself, and still, she would betray Imogene in her thoughts. Ruth got up from the table and wandered over to peer through the screen at the winking carnival lights of Nagawaki Beach across the lake. The waves, distinct in the streak of moonlight and invisible in the darkness on either side, seemed to move much more quickly than they did in the daytime, as if they were part of some frantic river. In their speed, they gave the illusion that the pavilion itself was sliding in the opposite direction, and Ruth had to grab the railing to keep her balance. She looked over her shoulder at the faces tilted back with laughter or forward in concentration. "Come on, Ruth," Imogene said, tugging at her arm. "We're going out in the boat again." It was just as before, Arthur steadying the women in their unsteady shoes one by one as they stepped off the pier, and Bobby standing below, helping them find their footing in the boat. Everyone was talking, laughing, reminding Bobby to bring enough liquor, and ribbing him about the morning's race.
"I was starting to get dizzy watching you re-round that mark," Arthur said.
"I had to give you a chance to catch up. Wasn't I taking my spinnaker down before you'd even finished your reach?"
"But Maynard and Arthur picked the right side of the lake on that last windward leg," Kitty put in.
Ruth could tell she'd said it to prove she knew what they were talking about, while Ruth and Imogene did not. Kitty paused a moment before stepping forward after she took Arthur's hand.
"It isn't fair that you're always the last one in," she said.
"I like my job, as long as Bobby doesn't leave without me."
Kitty looked at Arthur significantly.
"Shall I save you a seat?"
"Sure."
He sounded surprised, Ruth thought, taken aback. But still, he said, "Sure."
Kitty nodded.
"See you soon, then."
And keeping her eyes down as she stepped from the gunwale to the seat, she wiggled the fingers of her free hand in the air. Imogene, whose turn was next, also looked at Arthur, and Ruth saw her smile, as if the whole outing had not in a matter of seconds been ruined for her. She took his hand lightly, only touching her fingers to his palm, weightless and undemanding.
"Bobby," she said, turning away and planting her delicate shoe with its high stalk of a heel on the gunwale,
"catch me!"
She didn't mean it. She didn't jump into his arms, nothing so reckless as that. But she stepped into the boat too quickly, with too much of her mind focused on acting blithe instead of on placing her feet. She reached for Bobby's shoulder just as he was putting his hands around her waist, but somehow he lost his balance, and they both tumbled to the floor. Imogene was laughing and groaning at once.
"Jeannie, are you all right?"
Ruth jumped into the boat, and Arthur followed her.
"Yes, fine. No, I don't think so," she yelped as she tried to put weight on her foot and crumpled onto the seat.
"And she's an actress, too, our little eau de grub," Zita whispered to Kitty.
"I'm all right," Imogene insisted, but Arthur said he'd better take her home, and she let herself be helped out of the boat and carried off the pier.
"He's come to visit every day," Imogene crowed from the chaise in her mother's front room on Sunday. She kept to herself the words and kisses by which he'd made his intentions clear at last.
"So it was worth it?"
"You don't think I did this on purpose, do you?" She leaned forward to rub the swollen ankle she'd propped on a pile of pillows. "Although I was so mad at that Kitty, I wanted to push her in the drink."
"I know, she's hideous. Let's not have anything more to do with those people."
"But they're Arthur's friends. If Arthur and I..."
"It's so sweet of you, Ruth, dear, to do this for Jeannie," Mrs. Lindgren said, interrupting her daughter as she came into the room. She stood behind Imogene and smoothed the girl's hair behind her ears.
"Ugh, your hands smell," Imogene protested, but she let her head fall against her mother's arm.
"I told her 100 times, Mrs. Lindgren went on indulgently, "that she'd tip right over in those shoes, but she never listens."
"What am I doing for you, Imogene?"
"Mother, you didn't give me a chance to ask her yet."
Imogene turned to Ruth. "The thing is, everyone's being unreasonable about my ankle. Dr. Carbler says I can't walk on it at least for another day, and Mother's scared I'll fall on that hill if I use the crutches. I hate to let Mrs. Owens down. Would you fill in for me tomorrow? But I'm an awful secretary."
"It doesn't matter. She won't rush you, and mostly I do things like answer the telephone and sort the mail. Anyone can do it. It's simple. Personal, bills, charity," she mimed, putting each in a separate pile. "Pay the bills, keep the accounts, and as far as the charity stuff goes, Mrs. Owens will look at each piece and tell you what to do. Aunt Amanda won't like me missing Browns, not after she's paid for it."
"Do you have to tell her? It's only one day, Ruth."
Ruth bit one of her thumbnails. "I suppose for one day it'd be all right. Might as well see if I can do this stuff I'm supposed to have learned. What'll I do until the mail comes?"
"Oh, you'll find something. I'm sure I left some letters from last week on the desk to be typed and sent out. Or you can get Arthur to give you a tour of the house."
"I couldn't do that."
"I'm only joking. Don't worry, someone will tell you what to do."
Imogene's voice followed Ruth as she left.
"Don't forget to wear something nice."
Chapter 15. Amanda. In November, the baby was so large in front of me, I had to lean back to keep my balance. That must be why I didn't see Joe until he was already on the grass.
partway up the path to the house. I was standing at the bottom of the front steps, half-heartedly rolling the acorns off the walk with a broom. There was nowhere to hide, not even a decent shrub to cover me now that the leaves had dropped. My middle stood out starkly behind the narrow broomstick. I ran. Heavy as I was, running, it seemed, was still what I did best. I ran around the back of the house and pushed Matilda out the front. Joe had come with a letter. Carl was on his way home. In the yard, Matilda danced. She swooped Ruth off her feet and danced. She twirled and danced. She danced with Joe. She danced with Ruth. Carl was coming home. I sat on Ruth's little bed, trying to keep the panic down. Inside of me, the baby danced, just like Maddie. It kicked up its heels and danced and danced. Before Joe left, he also told Matilda a sad story. I could imagine him, holding his cap and bowing his head, pretending he wasn't thinking about what he'd seen inside of me. Poor Mary Louise had had her baby, a girl as still as ice. Amanda steered a straight course through the early morning mist, one hand on the little four-horse Evinrude Joe had given her when he bought a more powerful one for himself. The motor buzzed so loudly she couldn't think, but she had to think. She hadn't decided what she would say or how she would say it, but Arthur had to leave Imogene alone. That much was obvious. And Clement, if he had any ideas, but that was unthinkable. Anyway, she told herself firmly, the time had come to make clear that this was her place, not his, and that he had caused enough trouble for one lifetime. As she drew close to his boathouse, the smell nearly beat her back. The weed barge must have been cutting that morning, and a sea of weeds, studded with dead fish, clogged the water all along the shore. She killed the motor before the stringy fronds could tangle in the propeller, and rowed the little distance to the pier. She tied her boat, and then on an impulse got out and sat on the boards where she'd seen him sunbathe. She stretched her legs out full in front of her and tipped her chin back to catch the sun. She faced the middle of the lake, away from the lawn from which she knew he'd come. If anyone else found her first, well, let them. "Motor trouble," his voice sang over the weed-choked water, deep and clear as she remembered it. She turned to look at him over her shoulder. Dazzled by the brightness that had been beating against her eyelids, she could at first see only light and shadow. He was just stepping from the grass to the sand, and he raised his hand to shade his eyes. "Need help?" She didn't answer, could not answer. Her throat seemed to have swollen shut, and she trembled. It had been a mistake to come, a terrible error to think his betrayal would no longer sear her. Slowly, she turned to face him, tucking her knees under her chin and wrapping her arms around them to hold herself together. When he reached the pier, he was no longer looking straight into the sun. "Amy?" He squinted in her direction, frowning, and then glanced quickly but unmistakably back toward the house before hurrying toward her. The boards of the pier sprang under his weight so that she rose and fell with each of his steps. It seemed natural, his bending to give her his hand. Her cheek brushed the arm of his bathrobe as she allowed him to help her to her feet. She smelled the same old soap he'd used so many years ago, and those months with him rushed back upon her. Yes, for an instant she felt pleasure above all, as his nearness confirmed that a young, hopeful Amanda had once existed and was remembered, and the sweetness of this sensation was only intensified by the bitter realization that she existed no more. This man knew her, had known her, she corrected herself, however much he'd abused that knowledge. He stared and stared at her, shaking his head in surprise. "Amy, look at you, just look at you." And against her will she exulted in his approval. But she pulled herself back, sorry she'd let him, of all people, catch her up again. "I need to talk to you." Of course, Amy, but..." And he glanced, rather furtively, she noticed, to either side along the lakeshore. "Not here, I think." "Say," he said, brightening, "why don't we take your boat and get away from this stink?" She hesitated. She wanted to get it over with, but she still hadn't decided exactly what she meant to say. "Keep your son away from my friend's daughter?" It hardly sounded convincing. "All right," she said. Talking to him would be easier, she told herself, if they weren't standing on his pier in full sight of his wife's windows. The moment he stepped into her boat, she realized she hated him. He rowed a few strokes to get them clear of the weeds, and she kept on hating him, hated the certainty with which he handled the oars, just as he had once handled her. She gave the cord on the motor two fierce tugs, and the Evinrude sputtered to life. Slowly, the tiny engine barely creating a ripple behind them, they crept into deeper water. They didn't try to talk over the engine noise. Finally, Clement, who'd been looking over Amanda's shoulder at the receding shoreline, said, "Might as well stop here as anywhere." Amanda noticed they were too far from shore to be seen, although not if the viewer had a pair of binoculars. "So, Amy, what is it? Do you need money?" It was her turn to stare at him. "Money? No, of course not." "Well, lots of people do these days. It's nothing to be ashamed of, and I'd be happy to see what I could do. I don't know how much exactly, but I'm sure I could loan you something."
"Clement, stop. I don't need money."
"Well, what then?" She looked away from him over the water.
What?
What did she want to say? "Imogene is our daughter." Was that it? She opened her mouth. "Why don't you go ahead and take your swim?" she said.
"What?
I mean, I suppose you meant to take a swim this morning. You're dressed for swimming, aren't you? Why don't you go ahead as long as we're out here, away from the weeds?"
Obviously puzzled, he said nothing at first, and then began to loosen the knot securing his bathrobe.
"Well, all right," he said. "Maybe I will. I like to get in at least a couple of laps every day. Then maybe we can drive around a bit. See that island you were always telling me about."
He remembered the island. Amanda felt disproportionately grateful, and then disgusted with herself for that gratitude. It was funny, she thought, as he took off his robe and climbed onto the seat, how comfortable he acted with her, as if she had no reason to hate him, as if they'd parted on good terms and not very long ago at that, as if none of the terrible things she'd experienced had happened. He dove, shoving the boat several feet away from him as he thrust himself forward. Of course, as far as he knew, nothing much had happened. She'd cried, and they'd broken off. That was all. She realized with a start that he might even think she'd come back to him, that she didn't care anymore that he was married. Or perhaps that was ungenerous, she thought, as she watched his slow crawl away from the boat. Perhaps he was only glad to see her again. Perhaps he thought she'd forgiven him. Ruth reached under the collar of her dress and tugged at the strap that threatened to slip down her arm. It was 8:30. She was a full half hour early. Below her, the lake shimmered invitingly. Fishing boats, manned by those irregular types who had no morning employment, lounged in the pockets along its edges. And far out, a man was diving from a little rowboat, his white torso shining in the strong new sun. Once she'd begun straying toward the sparkling waters, the slope pulled her down the hill until she was standing on a concrete seawall. 2 feet below, the lake at its annual low point swelled and receded biliously, raising and lowering its fetid cargo of red and white bobbers, brown paper sandwich wrappers, and stinking dead fish, all caught in a net of weeds. Ruth backed away. She might as well go early to work. "Coffee?" the maid asked when she'd shown Ruth upstairs to a bright room, in which a rolled-top desk stood against one wall.
"Oh, no, thank you." Ruth slipped her hand over a scorched spot she just noticed on her skirt.
"Miss Lindgren always has coffee, with cream and 3 sugars, like a confection."
The woman frowned disapprovingly and with that left the room, shutting the door behind her, and Ruth was left alone to regret declining the coffee. She fingered the key in the desk. Should she wait or open it? Imogene should have given her more direction. Ruth paced around the room, passing her eyes over engravings and the spines of books, without any real awareness of what she was seeing. She didn't want to be caught snooping. She could imagine Mrs. Owens in her wide-shouldered cinnamon suit and feathered hat, although probably she wouldn't be wearing the hat at home, bursting in, wondering why she hadn't gotten started. Hadn't Jeannie said there was some typing? Ruth went back to the roll top, turned the key, and slid the top open. Yes, there was a Remington, and a stenographer's notebook open to a page of Imogene's neat shorthand. She slid into the desk chair, separated a clean sheet of paper from the stack, and rolled it into the typewriter. 20 minutes later, she was leaning over the machine, trying to decide whether a mistyped I could be adequately covered with an L, or whether she ought to start the page over, as her instructors at Brown's would have insisted. The door opened behind her.
"It doesn't have to be perfect, just legible," Mrs. Owens said.
Mrs. Owens, Ruth saw, would never burst into a room. She was stately and poised. In her gray dress, she looked something like a great blue heron. She glided forward, extending her hand.
"You must be Rose. I'm so grateful to you for filling in for Imogene this week."
Her skin, smooth and cool, made Ruth conscious of the ink on her own fingers.
"Didn't Ellen bring you any coffee?"
And before Ruth could protest, Mrs. Owens was speaking into a device in the wall.
"Would you bring coffee for two, please, Ellen? And don't forget the cream and sugar."
She turned back to Ruth and whispered, "Ellen doesn't approve of sweets." For an hour or so, Mrs. Owens paced around the room as she dictated notes for a speech, convincing her circle to donate funds to establish a summer camp for poor children.
"Help me, Rose.
I need to say something about fresh air, the importance of fresh air and exercise for both physical and moral growth. How can we expect these children to develop into upstanding citizens if we don't expose them to the healthy innocence of the countryside?"
"Yes, that's good, Rose. Get that down."
Then, while Ruth transcribed the most promising lines, Mrs. Owens made telephone calls.
"Well," she sighed, setting the receiver down after the third call, "I guess that's all I'm going to get done today. I've got to ooh and ah over the new pulmonary wing at St. Joseph's. If you could just finish up the typing and copy these into the appointment book, it would be such a help. If anything conflicts, let me know." She handed Ruth a few letters.
"Ellen will bring you lunch, of course. Just call her through the intercom whenever you want it."
"All right," Ruth said, although she knew she could never summon Ellen.
"I'll see you tomorrow, then. Or Imogene."
"Imogene, I think."
"Well, Rose," she said, giving Ruth her cool hand again, "you've been a great help. Thank you." And then she was gone. Ruth sat down to the typing. The paper she fed into the machine was luxuriously thick and soft, and a rich, creamy color. Nothing like the nearly transparent stuff flecked with bits of wood and rag they had to use at Brown's. When she held it to the light, the watermark floated in the center like a secret kiss. Why hadn't she told Mrs. Owens that her name wasn't Rose?
"Dear Mrs. Schmidt, I was so plased.
Carefully, Ruth rolled the paper out of her typewriter and inserted a new page.
"Dear Mrs. Schmidt, IWZS. Dear Mrs. not capitalized, DRE.
Ruth yanked the fourth sheet of paper out with a sharp, satisfying zip. Anyone who did that at Brown's had to pay a fine for damage to the machine. Not wanting Mrs. Owens to see how many sheets of expensive letter paper she'd ruined, she folded her false starts and stuffed them into her pocketbook. She walked once around the room to collect herself and then sat down again. A hairpin poked her scalp. One by one, she drew pins out, searching for the culprit, until her hair hung freely down her back. Except for the typewriter, everything on the desk was decorated to suggest a whimsical aquatic theme. She picked up a letter opener with a silver handle scaled like a fish. Beside that crouched a green enamel box shaped like a frog from whose mouth protruded a tongue of stamps. She tore several off, licked them, and applied them to envelopes. She would type the addresses later. Then she turned to the appointment book, which was covered in bottle green leather and had its own little gold pen stuck in a ring on the side. Ruth filled in each obligation from the cards and letters Mrs. Owens had given her. First she wrote in pencil in case she made a mistake, and then she traced over the pencil with the gold pen. The telephone rang, and she jumped. Was she supposed to answer it? She waited. It rang again. Two rings, three, four. Why wasn't Ellen or someone downstairs picking it up? Finally, on the sixth ring, she lifted the receiver. "Hello?" But no one was there. Ruth flipped back and forth through the appointment book. Soldier's Home Luncheon, Tea for St. Anne's, S. Lemon, Avis Home, Garden Club, Library Benefit, Athletic Club, Red Cross, Women's Club, Dinner at the Joneses. She pretended to answer a call.
"Yes, this is Mrs. Owen's secretary. Let me see. I can squeeze you in between 2:30 and 3 o'clock on Wednesday. Will that be all right?" "Thank you. Goodbye."
She wished the telephone would ring again. Ruth closed the appointment book and stuck the pen back into its holder. She got up from the roll-top desk, moved to the table where Mrs. Owen sat, and reached for the fountain pen as if it were her own. She tried her signature on the back of an old envelope, Ruth Sapphira Newman. Out the window at the bottom of the hill, the lake like wrinkled tinfoil threw sunbeams in every direction. Finally, she returned to the desk and rolled a fresh sheet of paper into the typewriter. "Dear Mrs. Schmidt," she pecked, keeping to a slow but steady rhythm, "I was so pleased to talk with you last Thursday." Silently, Arthur opened the door to his mother's study. It had become his habit to surprise Imogene when his mother was out, to sneak as close to her as he could before she detected his presence, or at least before she let on that she noticed him. His first reaction, when he realized it was not Imogene who sat typewriting with her back to the door, was embarrassment at what he'd planned. When he recognized Ruth, his blood jolted. From surprise, he assured himself. That was all that affected him, surprise. "Hello," he said from the doorway. As she whirled around, her wrist struck an inkwell, but she caught it deftly before it could fly off the table and disgorge its blue-black innards onto the Persian carpet. She uttered only a startled, "Oh!" then turned away in confusion, reaching to set the ink far back on the desk. "I'm sorry, I didn't mean to startle you." He took two steps into the room. He could think of nothing else to say. "Jeannie should be back tomorrow, Wednesday at the latest." "Is she ill?" Ruth, struggling to put her loose hair back together, had stuck two pins in her mouth. "They won't let her walk on her ankle," she said as well as she could through closed teeth. "Her ankle, of course. Is it better?" "Not really. That's why they won't let her walk on it." He was making her nervous. The way he looked at her could almost be described as expectant, as if he thought she might suddenly say or do something amusing. As far as she knew, she'd never done anything to give him that impression. "That's right. She shouldn't walk on it." He picked up the stamp box frog and set it down again. "It's very nice of you to fill in." She shrugged. "Otherwise I'd have to go to Brown's, and I can't stand Brown's." "Why'd you go, then?" There it was again, that little smile of anticipation. "Because Imogene thought I should typewrite, and they promised to teach me. Not that I've learned," she added honestly. "But I don't think that's their fault." He laughed. "Typewriting's not important." "Well, not to you, maybe. But to me it is, or at least it should be. Maybe you haven't noticed, but there are precious few jobs out there." "And this is what you want to be, a typewriter?" "No," she admitted, "not really. But what you want doesn't always matter, does it?"
"I guess not."
He crossed the room to look out the window toward the lake. "Next week I start work for my brother," he said, drumming his fingers on the table. Then he turned back to her.
"Say, we shouldn't be inside today."
"We shouldn't?"
"Summer's almost over, isn't it? We have to take advantage."
Ruth looked doubtfully at the paper in the machine. "You go ahead, I have to finish these letters."
"But I thought you said you couldn't typewrite."
"I told your mother I'd do them."
He picked up the little stack of handwritten letters and counted the pages. "If I do these for you, will you go with me?"
"You can't type."
"Of course I can."
He nudged her out of the chair. Then he rolled up his sleeves and adjusted the chair's position as if preparing for great labor.
"Ah, Mrs. Schmidt," he said, rubbing his hands together as he examined the letter she'd begun. "What shall we say to Mrs. Schmidt?"
He began to type with two fingers in swift, decisive strokes, every half minute or so returning the carriage with a hearty swipe. Ruth, watching the lines emerge from the machine, belatedly remembered to spread her fingers over the scorch in her skirt.
"My father made me learn a few years ago," he said as he started on the next letter. "He said I had to keep up with improvements. But I have to say, I'm not sorry now."
He looked up at her quickly, shyly, as the carriage bell dinged. She watched, fascinated by the certainty of his fingers, and lulled by the clack of the keys, until he pulled the last page out. He joggled the finished letters together and tapped their edges on the desk.
"Okay, so now can we go?"
In that car with him, without Imogene pressed between them, Ruth leaned tentatively against the back of the seat, aware that there was nothing but space between her thigh and his. She kept her eyes on the sky, a washed, clean, hard blue, and the rough stubble of the recently cut fields. After a while, though, she began to relax. She opened the window as far as it would go and played idly with one hand in the streaming air. The wind teased her hair down again, and she let it snarl, only holding it back with one hand to keep the whipping tendrils from her face. "Too fast?" he asked, with the same shy, sideways glance he'd given her at the typewriter. "No, I like it." They passed fields and farmhouses and barns and little stores with the words groceries, beer, bait, and beer, food, dry goods, and cheese, chickens, beer painted on their walls. "Where are we going?" Ruth asked finally. "I don't know," he shrugged. "How about a picnic? You hungry?"
"Starved."
He pulled over next to one of the all-purpose stores, a place made of whitewashed stone with two tiny windows. Inside, Arthur started toward an icebox and back, and Ruth followed slowly behind. She liked this store. It was like a cave, pleasantly damp and cool after the dry wind of the road. As she moved along the row of shelves, examining the packages, blackberry, strawberry, raspberry jam, corn flakes, soap flakes, matches, she smelled first mothballs, then vinegar, then cloves, and then cigarettes, and rancid sweat.
"What you doing with him?"
Ruth jumped at the raspy whisper behind her back, knocking a can of tuna to the floor. An old man whose head came only to her shoulder scowled up at her. "Nothing," she said, diving to retrieve the can. She pushed it onto the shelf and backed toward the door. "I'll be outside, Arthur, okay? I'll wait outside." What gave that crazy old man the right to talk to her like that? She leaned against the warm, whitewashed wall. They were friends on a drive, she should have said. They were taking advantage of the last summer weather. Honestly, she wished Imogene were with them. Safely back in the car, they pointed out pretty views and charming houses, and were pleased to discover that their tastes were just the same. They talked about the people they knew, which reminded them of stories about people they'd known. Arthur told Ruth he'd been thinking he might want to learn to build bridges, and Ruth told Arthur about how Amanda had taught her to throw fits and bark like a dog to keep her out of school. "Let's see," he said, and she demonstrated, and he laughed so hard he swerved the car. He turned onto a smaller road. "Do you know where you're going?" she said as the small road became a dirt track. "My father and I used to stop somewhere around here." He leaned over her to look out the window. He led her finally to a little river where he made a nest of rocks for the beer to cool. Then they sat on the grass and he hacked at the salami with his pocket knife while she tore the bread. "Imogene should be back tomorrow," she said, piling haphazard sandwiches on brown paper between them. "Oh? That's good." "Yes, her ankle really isn't so bad. I mean, it was bad, but it's better now. Her mother just wanted her to be careful."
"She should be careful."
He fetched the beer and watched her throat ripple as she swallowed. The condensation dripped off the bottle onto her skirt.
"I hate to leave the lake next week," he said.
"But you wouldn't like it in the winter. It's bleak and empty as the moon."
"I don't mind that. You can do things outside here, not just scurry from building to building like we do in the city."
"Mostly we scurry from building to building, too," Ruth laughed, "if we're lucky."
"Well, I hope I have a reason to come back for the weekends, anyway."
He blushed and pulled a few bunches of grass from the ground. They made the light tearing sound a sheep would make cropping. "He means Imogene," she thought. "He loves Imogene." Did this grieve her because he would have Imogene or because Imogene would have him? Both, she supposed. Both left her alone. But she was Imogene's friend. That was the important thing. And she would be Imogene's friend, with or without her. "Imogene would make a very good wife," she said.
"Yes, I'm sure she would," he said seriously. "A man would be lucky to have her."
Suddenly he tossed the grass he'd collected into the air so that it fell like confetti onto their heads.
"Let's take a walk."
One blade dangled just above her eye. He reached forward to slide it from her hair, and she felt a tiny pang as his finger touched her forehead. "Stop that," she thought. "You mustn't feel that way again." Briskly, she stood up and brushed the grass from her dress. "No," she said. "It's getting late. My aunt will worry. You'd better take me home." Chapter 16. Amanda. I had to admit it was lovely there on the water, with the fresh breeze shearing the waves and the sun's warmth soaking under my blouse. The morning had lured three sailboats from their docks, and they zigged and zagged on the dark blue water, their canvas brilliant white triangles against the light blue sky. Clement swam so close that the spray thrown up by his kicking wet my cheeks. Wasn't this enough? More than enough? Our happiness, after all, had once been real, even if he'd lied to spur it on. Why had I, in insisting that I be the most prized, the only beloved, hidden myself away from such delights? After his second lap, he hung on to the boat, breathing laboriously. Now that his hair was wet and plastered to his skull, I could see how much it had thinned. I wanted to reach over and take his hand. Shh, shh, I wanted to say. Shh, it's all right. Rest now. Come back in the boat and rest. It made me sad to see him diminished, a man who'd been so vital. But his weakness also made me fond. Of course, I'd been mistaken about what I'd thought I'd seen a few mornings before. Clement wasn't what he had been. He'd no designs on Imogene. My own suspicious nature had created my fears. I wanted to tell him about her. I wanted him to know that, in the end, he and I had produced such a one. "I want to tell you about Imogene," I said. "Imogene Lindgren." Squinting up at me, he sighed. Yes, I think he sighed. "She's lovely, isn't she?" he said. "In fact, if I weren't so old..." He looked away from me then, far off toward the other side of the lake, and then he looked back. He may even have winked, although maybe he was blinking water from his eyes. "But who knows what the young girls like nowadays," he said. "I might have a chance yet." As he spoke, he turned and pushed off the boat with his feet, so his last words were nearly washed away by the swoosh of the water. But I know I heard them. Otherwise, why would I have felt such a cold horror prickling my skin? And then I felt the sun burning and raging in my veins. I wanted to ram him with the boat, to drive the propeller over his smug white back so that it shredded into ribbons like a worn sheet. I wanted to leap in and hold his head under with my own hands, but I didn't. Of course I didn't. I could never do any of those things. Instead, I stood up in the boat and shouted for the whole lake to hear, "She's your daughter! Your daughter!" But he didn't stop. I tugged viciously at the cord and the motor growled. He must have raised his head at last when the whine reached his ears. Bewildered, he must have watched me go, but I did not look back. The motor was slow, so damnably slow, it seemed to take hours to crawl away from him across the water, days to reach the shore. Halfway home, I hurled the terrycloth robe from the boat. It flung its arms into the air, settled on the surface of the lake, and then slowly, as it became waterlogged, began to sink. As I dragged the boat after me onto the muddy shore, I imagined Clement climbing out of the water, calling for a sandwich. He would be ravenous after such a long swim, and my fury would have done no damage to his other appetites either. At least he'd have had to push through those weeds. He was a monster, a monster! His smell lingered on my skin, and I waded into the waves to scrub my hands and to cool my face, which still burned with outrage. Nagawaki is not a large lake. Anyone can swim its width. How was I to guess he couldn't do what a 10-year-old child can do? I'd forgotten about his weak heart. Is that true? To be honest, I don't know. Chapter 17 Amanda. I wasn't ready when the baby was. I wanted to stay forever in limbo, not going forward, not going back, just still. But the baby couldn't be still. We were going on whether I liked it or not. The pains began at noon on a bright, achingly cold day. Recklessly, I stood at the edge of the island for a last taste of air, daring the world to see. I exulted in the force of the wind, beating and gusting along the new green ice, cold enough to bring tears to my eyes. And then my insides squeezed again. My water broke around 7. I sterilized the scissors, stifling thoughts of that absurd vacuum box, and laid them out with string on a clean towel. I placed my shoes side by side under the bed in Matilda's room, the one we decided to use. I took off my dress and hung it neatly on the hook behind the door. Matilda, poor little thing, flew back and forth from kitchen to bedroom, sometimes carrying a glass of water or a blanket, mainly just to be doing something. But I was calm. I was ready. A contraction gripped me, and I made a sound that must have frightened Ruth.
Aunt Mandy hurt?
Come on, sweetheart, Matilda said, holding out her hand to the child. Let's go in your room now. Ruth shook her head. Yes, we have to go now. Be good, Ruthie. But Ruth lowered herself to a crouch, and before Matilda could scoop her up, scuttled under the bed, drawing the rag rug in after her as a barricade. Matilda reached under and tried to pull her out, but Ruth clamped onto the leg of the bed and howled. I had a better idea. I slipped off the bed and went into the kitchen for a peppermint stick. Look, Ruth, I said, holding the striped stick as close to the floor as I could. Shh, now. Aunt Mandy's got candy. But another contraction made me gasp. The peppermint dropped with a crack as I grabbed hold of Maddie. She helped me back on the bed, and we let Ruth be. Ruth floating face down, her body spread over the waves like a blue terry cloth bathrobe. Reach, farther, reach, there. The hair, hold on. Pull her up, pull her out. Amanda awoke, her fingers clutching the air, gasping as if she'd been the one trying to breathe underwater. Ruth isn't drowned, she told herself firmly. Ruth is fine. She'd fallen asleep fully clothed, and the hem of her dress was still damp where it had draggled in the water when she heaved the boat out. Her collar had pulled tight around her throat as she slept. Perhaps that accounted for her breathlessness, and she loosened the top two buttons. The day had faded, but it was not yet dusk. Ruth would be home soon, if she was not already. Ruth? Amanda stood at the top of the stairs and called down. There was no answer. Turning, she faced herself in the landing mirror. Her skin red from the sun, her hair snarled and matted, her dress wrinkled. She raised a tentative hand to her cheek. She'd never had what people called a full face, but lately her bones had become more prominent, her cheeks hollow. White wires threaded through her hair. What kind of a girl gets so dirty? Her mother's voice said in her mind, but so clearly that she turned around, half expecting to see her standing there, holding a washcloth and a brick of her homemade lavender soap. But that would have been downstairs near the tub by the stove in the kitchen. Carl had long since put in the bathroom upstairs by walling off a corner of Ruth's room, the room Amanda and Matilda had once shared. She took a fresh dress from the closet and hung it on the bathroom door. While she waited for the tub to fill, she brushed her teeth with a little baking soda, scrubbed the sink and the toilet with cleanser. In her hair, she could still catch the odor of the dead fish and weeds she'd encountered that morning. She'd have to wash it, even though it was probably too late in the day for it to dry properly. Slowly, she lowered herself into the tub. She hadn't realized how cold and tense she'd been, and the warm water soothed her. She lay back in it, letting her feet and hands float. Lazily, she caressed herself, her stomach and her thighs, the bones and the soft dip at the base of her throat, her breasts. Then she slid deeper, tipping her head back to soak her hair. The water rose gently like a warm hood over the back of her head, and her hair spread around her neck and over her chest like weeds. The water covered her ears, separating her from the sounds of the air, drawing her down and under. Amanda sat up suddenly and struggled out of the bath, water streaming from her toes and fingertips onto the mat. Quickly she dried herself and wrapped her hair in the towel. Then, her skin still damp, she pulled on her clothes. It was really food she needed. How long had it been since she'd eaten? She had to get some supper together. Ruth was always starving after a day wrestling with those typewriters. The stones in the driveway crunched and pinged as she was peeling the last potato. Amanda slipped to the window and looked out. A man, that Owens boy, Clement and not Clement, was handing Ruth out of the car. Amanda pulled the towel from her hair and tied a scarf around her head. But the car door slammed and then slammed again. The engine noises rose and fell away, and Ruth came into the kitchen alone. "You were with that Owens boy?" Amanda asked her, as matter-of-factly as she could manage. She lifted the lid from the pot roast, and an exhalation of steam masked her face. "Arthur? He gave me a ride." "But not Imogene?"
"No."
So now was it Ruth who had to be watched? Amanda frowned, studying the young woman's movements as Ruth began to set the table. Did you... She stopped herself, not sure how to say it. Drink anything? She finished delicately. Of course not. Anger, acerbic as bile, rose in Amanda at the thought of the father and son. Why would they not leave her and hers alone? But it was her own fault, she knew. Hiding and pretending, staying and lying, she had, in some sense, kept Clement Owens with her always. One night with him had become a sort of knot around which she'd grown for the last 20 years. Why should she be surprised now if, instead of dissolving, he'd doubled? But it would be all right, she assured herself. Summer was ending, and soon they would go. She only had to wait, holding things in place a little longer. Ruth was home safely, and now they would eat a well-balanced meal, Amanda told herself, spooning red cabbage onto Ruth's plate. Everything was all right, then. Everything was as it should be, she thought, surveying the table, except for one detail. Do you think we should have applesauce, Ruth? There's some in the icebox. Why don't you get it?
I don't eat applesauce.
Well, but I think we should have it. It's just in the icebox, in the little green dish. I really don't want applesauce tonight. But I think we should have it. Otherwise, we don't have any fruit, and fruit is very important. But let's have it on the table, at least, in case we change our minds. I want Imogene to be happy, Ruth said, getting up from the table. I really do. No, she shouldn't talk about Imogene, not tonight, not when everything had to be kept just so. We all want Imogene to be happy, of course. Ruth, on the top shelf behind the milk. You know, I wonder if it'll be too cold. Do you think it is? It shouldn't be so cold that it chills the meat. Maybe we ought to heat it for a minute so it isn't ice cold. But we were going to have our apartment. Apartment? What apartment? Amanda pushed her chair back slightly. She felt suddenly at a disadvantage with her legs trapped under the table. There is no apartment, not anymore. Jeannie's going to marry Arthur Owens. He hasn't asked her yet, but he will. With this jumble of strange syllables, a thickness filled Amanda's ears, followed by a ringing. She drew back from the table, shaking her head. No, she said firmly, almost brightly. No, that's impossible. Aunt Mandy, what's the matter? Are you sick? Is something wrong? Amanda stood up so abruptly that her chair toppled over behind her. We have to stop them. What are you talking about? What's the matter with you? Ruth had come around the table, and she pressed a palm to her aunt's clammy forehead. Maybe you should lie down. Do you want to lie down? She asked, steering Amanda toward the front room. She tried to sound solicitous, but she was afraid. Was this why Amanda had to go to St. Michael's? Should I call Dr. Carbler? No. No one else, Ruth. No one else. Only you. They were standing beside the old Davenport now, but when Ruth tried to lower her aunt onto it, Amanda clung and pulled her down, too. Promise you'll help me, Ruth, she whispered. Promise? Of course I'll help you. What is it? Amanda continued to whisper, as if in that way the words would not actually be spoken, but somehow pass from her to Ruth in a current of understanding. Imogene is Clement Owen's daughter. She's crazy, Ruth thought, involuntarily pulling back from Amanda, as a mixture of fear and disgust, bordering on nausea, rose in her throat. Stop it, she said. What's wrong with you? Stop acting like this. She felt an urge to slap her aunt, but Amanda began to cry then, and Ruth rubbed her shoulder instead. Now, Aunt Mandy, you know that's silly. I don't know who told you that, but you can't credit crazy stories. Mr. Owens and Mrs. Lindgren don't even know each other, and Mrs. Lindgren would never... A thought occurred to Ruth. I bet I know who started this. How dare they? That nasty Zita and Kitty. They'll be sorry. But Amanda had stopped crying. With fingers like claws, she gripped Ruth's shoulders and shook her. You stop it, Ruth! Look at me. Listen to me. This is no one's story but mine. No one knows it but me, only me. I know he's Imogene's father, because I am her mother. She's my baby. Ruth jerked out of Amanda's grip and turned her face away, covering her ears with her hands. Stop it! How can you say such a thing? If Amanda had suddenly insisted that, after all, the sky was green and the grass was red, Ruth could not have been more confused, more betrayed. Now, as she turned to stare at Amanda, it was her voice that was reduced to a whisper.
But you said the baby wasn't real.
Ruth. Mama's feet go back and forth, back and forth. Aunt Mandy makes the scary sounds. Shh, shh, I say, but nobody hears me. I put my head on the now I lay me down to sleep and watch the candy stick. Aunt Mandy's shoes are watching me. I better be good now, good and quiet. Shh, shh, I say, but nobody listens to me. Kick, Mama's shoe on the candy stick. It rolls to me and I pick it up, pick the fur off with my fingers. It's still good, I tell myself. That's what Aunt Mandy would say to me. We don't mind a little